kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 65, Licensing Educational Content, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Good evening, Doug. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but I know that you're even better because you're on half term.
Well, yes. I am. So half term started on Saturday lunchtime, and I'm very much enjoying cleaning my flat, getting my washing done at a nice pace, and, you know, cooking for myself again, which is quite nice. Doing very little at the moment, just sort of recovering from working crazy hours as you have to do in a boarding school.
Very good, very good. So this week, I guess you've just been chilling out a bit and taking it easy from the crazy life that is your term time regime.
Yeah, I have started my Digital Learning Party Google Plus community, which I did on Saturday morning. It's probably a bit late in the day when everyone's running away. But so I've got 24, 25 people signed up to join in, and so I sent out the invitations because I couldn't work out. I couldn't get everyone into the Google Plus community. They just wouldn't let me add them. And then I realized they had to activate their Google Plus profile from within Google Apps for Education because
outside services. Oh, right. They just never used them
before. Yeah. And so they had to do that before I could invite them. So I just asked people to do that. So I've got a half a dozen people in there, and we're just posting about different uses of tools and stuff that people have done, a bit of Kahoot, a bit of...
There was an interesting presentation. I represented City and Guilds, one of my clients, at basically like a technology conference for one of the educational unions or professional associations or something like that. And one of the other presentations was by somebody who had been using Google Plus extremely successfully within his organization. And his message was just, look, and just screenshots. He said, this is after 2 years, we are now being successful. But it just took me keeping posting things, keeping reminding people that they could post things in this place, like saying that if they wanted the photographs from this event, they were going to be in Google Plus. Like, just keep on hammering it and hammering it and hammering it until people realized that this was a great place for organizational sharing of content.
Well, I think that's the case. I'm not 100% convinced about that, but I've been looking at Google Groups as well. They're turned on automatically within Google Apps for Education, and Google Plus isn't. And one of the problems with Google Plus is that you have to go through parental consent for under 13-year-olds. So you can't just turn it on for everyone in my organization because we have a couple of hundred pupils who are under 13. Mm. But other than that, I've just turned it on for everybody and will wait until things go wrong, until I change that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, we're going to come on to talk about educational content and different content licenses. And one of the, you know, I don't think it ever is a binary, but if you were representing that kind of stuff as a binary, there would be effectively two camps. One in which I want to prevent things going wrong, and the other which is I will wait until something's gone wrong to do something about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they are different approaches. So that's what I've been up to. What have you been up to?
So I haven't got as much work on at the moment, just that kind of time of year and things ebb and flow, but I had an interesting conversation with a potential client this morning, kind of reconnecting with some work that I'd done back with Kerry Facer about 4 years ago when we did Education for the Apocalypse at the very last Learning Without Frontiers.
Oh, okay. Graham Brown Martin's gig.
Yeah, so kind of work which potentially comes out of that with an international organization. I'll say more about it if it actually happens. It's one of those things that may or may not come off. I think I mentioned last week I've picked up a couple of writing gigs. Again, they haven't been published yet, so I'll not mention the exact publications. One of them is a new one, which is a kind of a spin-off from, I think, one of the most successful publications, which runs on Medium.com as a platform.
Okay.
So looking forward to seeing that. Very kind of, they're very different things. One of them is longer form content, a bit like my DML Central post, but very much focusing on technology. And I'm writing about openness there to start off with. And then the other one, they're looking for like between five and ten posts a week, 300 to 500 words on how to do one thing with SaaS, business SaaS software, so software as a service. So here's how to do this thing with Trello, or have you ever thought about using Evernote like this? That kind of stuff.
Okay. Mm. That'd be quite up your street as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it means that I have to do the reading. You know, when you do writing, you have to do the reading that goes with it. Otherwise, it's no good. So it forces me, a bit like my newsletter every week forces me to actually read the stuff that I bookmark. This will force me to read stuff that I know will actually be helpful much more widely than this blogging will.
Cool. Sounds good.
So, right. Yes, I'm also planning, and this is very in the very early stages as well, planning to do some workshops, both with We Are Open and with by myself, Dynamic Skillset. So I've got a date in mind, but I'll not mention it yet, and it'll probably be at London Connected Learning Centre in South London. For one day only in December to start off with, and then my plan is to start having at least a workshop a month, like a live workshop a month, hopefully, where people can come along and learn about openness and digital literacies and badges and different ways of looking at the world and educational technology and strategy and that kind of thing. And Victoria College have confirmed that I am doing that work around digital strategy with them, so looking forward to going back there.
Cool. On the mention of that, live workshops and things like that, you just reminded me of something we discussed before we started recording, which was possibly getting and doing a little Tide party maybe or something, or getting a few of those who the Tide podcast Slack channel to come along and join us maybe.
There's been a lot of activity in the Tide podcast Slack channel. If you're not a member of that and you're listening, it's not a big commitment, and if you've never used Slack before, it's just like a chat room. And it just seemed like a good idea to maybe have that running while we're recording an episode, which is going out live, so people can not only listen to this asynchronously, but they can get involved synchronously, and if not joining us via voice, they could potentially comment away while we're talking and streaming it out. I know that Stephen Downes has done stuff like that before, and we've got some kind of form in doing that when we did EdTech Roundup, especially the EdTech Roundup Teach Meet.
Yes, when we did a sort of virtual teach.
The first ever one, I think.
I think so. Mm-hmm. It was very good, but very complicated to set up. I wonder, actually, Slack has a video conferencing facility in it that I don't have access to because I don't pay for Slack, but you do. So are you able to activate that maybe? I don't know whether people could join through that.
If I paid for the Tide Podcast one, then yes.
But you don't. It's just a free one.
That's right, yeah. So I know that when I had the Dynamic Skillset one and I paid for that, then you could have... Like, it's not video calling, it's just audio calling. But there's many, many ways of doing that, Di. We can just use a different platform and stuff. But I very much appreciate, I mean, we definitely appreciate the comments that people have put in, especially today. So Donna has said that she's enjoying the new format, but that she has to concentrate a lot more because she can't just have us on for background noise.
Not sure that's such a good thing. Fair play. Okay, so this week we're going to focus on the licensing of educational content.
Mm.
So what's brought this about? Why?
Before we do, one thing I did want to mention, which Alan Ezekiel brought to my attention, thanks Alan, was Stoic Week 2016. I know that we've just been talking about this before we kind of pressed record, as it were, but I just wanted to mention it quickly because it's the kind of thing which you can do live. You know, if you happen to listen to this the week that this goes out, then you can participate live, as it were. But it's something you can do after the fact as well. Stoicism is something that's been around for thousands of years, so you can pick it up anytime. So Ilan and his wife are doing that this week. It's kind of reflecting and meditating on texts and that kind of thing. But one of the things... I mean, if I mentioned the word Stoicism to you before we had our little conversation there beforehand, Di, what would you have thought it was?
I always said it was about being stoic. It's about being robust in the face of adversity, essentially. That's
it's often conceptualized as being like this stiff upper lip and just being unfeeling, and that it's kind of training yourself to be almost some kind of machine. I guess there's an element of that, but it's more to do, in my mind, to being entirely self-reliant. So, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote that book, Self-Reliance, a classic American text. And in that, he talked about the idea of not needing other people. And it's not the sense that you're trying to cut yourself off from the world, it's just that it's realizing that you have everything you need to be mentally and physically self-sufficient in and of yourself, and that your relations with other people shouldn't start off from a position of dependency.
That makes sense. The school of philosophical thought, it's a new thing to me, so I can't really comment on it. I read some things about it today on Oxford something, an Oxford scholarship, I think it was. It said things about being vice-ridden, and it sounds like, not that it's religious, but it's quite aligned to religious thought.
So the thing it hasn't got like a doctrine, and it hasn't got like a core set of beliefs or anything like that. It's not a religion like that. It's more, here is a set of practices and habits, or an approach to the world which will help you in life. Mm-hmm. So it's been around for ages. It's not some kind of faddish mindfulness. It's not meditation in the sense of the Headspace app or anything like that. It's more the original sense of meditation, I guess, reflecting on writing and what people have said and written and thinking about how to apply that to your own life. And so one of the things it recommends, which is something I do anyway, is getting up early and reading through texts and reflecting on them and thinking about your day. And this classic text, for example, like Marcus Aurelius, I very much enjoy, the 17th century Jesuit priest Balthasar Gratian, who's a lesser known one, but basically saying there's going to be people who are going to piss you off today, and you have to realize that they are separate people, you know, separate from you, and you have to expect people to be like that. And you don't know why they're acting like that, and you can't blame them. You have to just not let it get to you and try and be like a steady ship and emotionally centered, that kind of thing. To me, yeah. You know, I go to Pilates on a Monday night, which is all about kind of core flexibility and being measured in your actions and having inner strength. And to me, it's kind of the mental equivalent of that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have a read and have a look.
So it's free to register, and the handbook to download is free, and all of the writings are free because they're like 2,000 years old.
Well, that's an interesting thing. So you're telling me that the content of this is not licensed?
I think it is licensed. What does it say on the thing? It says that that one's copyright, isn't it? But it's freely downloadable.
Okay.
Well, that's a nice segue, actually. So licensing educational content.
So I'll set him up. You just hit him out. That's
absolutely
fine.
Absolutely.
That was a little TV link, radio link.
I like what you did. So actually, let's just take this as an example. The handbook from a website called Stoicism Today, the Stoic Week 2016 handbook. They are giving this away for free. And although it doesn't say that you can't download it, with, like you can't pass it around, it does say that it's copyright. So if you try to sell this, if you use it in a way that the authors didn't like, then they could shut you down. They could stop you from doing it, and they could potentially sue you if you made financial gain off it. Okay?
Yeah.
My doctoral thesis, most of my blog posts, if you pass those along, that's fine. Just as like the Stoicism Today handbook is fine to pass on, and it's free. But the other thing is, you can do literally anything you want to with that. You can change all the text. You can put your own name on it and pretend it was yours. Anything you want, because it's in the public domain. It's CC0, Creative Commons 0 licensed, basically. So very much different in terms of the copyright which is put on it. Not the freedom, not the cost of it, but the copyright of it.
Yes.
So you use Creative Commons in your work, don't you, Di?
I do. Yes, no, so I just put, well, so to say that, I'm not really a big user of Creative Commons in that way. I don't think it's, so I license everything that goes out on my blog that people can use it as they wish. I don't imagine anyone ever does. So the only stuff I've ever had used is quotes from, I used to put my MA work on my blog, and, or I did when I did it, and people asked if they could quote it in their MAs. Oddly, which were probably about the same thing, the same base content, looking at distributive leadership and that kind of thing. And they contacted me on the blog and asked if they could use it. And they're the only ones I know. Other people might have used things that I've used without actually telling me.
That's the main thing. So with Creative Commons, and if you've never heard of this before, I'm sure a lot of people listening will have done. If you go to creativecommons.org, then they've got this new shiny website. And the difference between copyright and Creative Commons is that copyright is saying all rights reserved. I have every single right around this product, and I might give you like a license to use it. Whereas Creative Commons says that there's some rights reserved, and that as long as you meet this criteria. So which license do you use, Di?
So the only thing that I want is to be informed that it's going to be used. So it can be used for modification, for commercial purposes, etc. I just want it to be...
You have to be attributed, yeah. So you don't get like notified that it's being used, but you do get attributed, yeah?
Yes, that's what I'm after.
So that's the CC BY license. So basically all that means is that if somebody uses a photo that you took, or they use a particular bit of text or whatever, more than just a quotation, then they would have to say this is from Die Barnes using a Creative Commons by license. And there's other modifiers like you mentioned there. There's the modifier to say that people can use this as long as they're not using it for commercial purposes, i.e. they're not making money from it. Brian Mathers, hi Brian if you're listening, he uses a Creative Commons by ND, which means no derivatives. So he doesn't want anybody just kind of chopping out bits of his wonderfully crafted images. He wants them either using all of it or none of it. So he has that kind of no derivatives clause. And then the other one, which is an interesting hack, and I know that Joss Wynn at Lincoln University always insists on this, is the share alike license, the SA bit. And the reason that that's interesting is that if you imagine a chain, if you imagine that, I don't know, you take a photograph, Di, and then I take it and then change it somehow, and you've done it under a Creative Commons license, and then I do the same under the same Creative Commons license, and then a third party comes along and takes my remix of your work, and then they remix it even further. If you haven't originally put a share-alike license on there, the chain could stop there. They wouldn't have to release their work, their remix, under a Creative Commons license. So the share-alike bit means that, yes, you can use my work as long as your remix of it, as long as your use of it, is itself under a Creative Commons license.
I'm just putting in a link to the license types. Yes, yeah, so it kind of makes sense, isn't it? But the more I've read about this today, the more I thought that for the work that I do, licensing on a CC0 is a good idea. So that means no share alike, no attribution, no nothing. Just giving it away.
So you don't even have to. There's no attribution. It's just this is available. I have made this, and it's available for you to do whatever you like with. So. The thing which prompted my post this week and Maha Bali's post was original one by Alan Levine, who is Cogdog on Twitter and his blog and everywhere else, and it's not the first time we've mentioned him. And he's doing some work with Creative Commons at the moment around certification. We are open, and the co-op that I'm part of has done some work with them. And what he's trying to do, after being prompted by Brett Gaylor, who I used to work with at Mozilla, who's a filmmaker who made that a remix manifesto documentary and other things like that. Brett challenged Alan Levine to release things under a CC0 license. And so Alan is just basically talking about in this post about how kind of his thought process and also what he did to license something like 50,000 photos as a Creative Commons Zero license on Flickr. And it was so many photos, I think, that it actually broke the Flickr API or something, and the Flickr staff had to flick the switch on his behalf.
Yes, so obviously it had some kind of quantity limits on it, and he tried to change. But he has an interesting thing. So he says in his post, he says in 2006, he put a CC BY license on his Flickr photos. And then in 2010, he had reason to change it to CC BY NC. Which is no credit, or what does that mean? I'm going to go look at my types.
It's non-commercial, so it means you can't use these and make money off them.
Yeah, so BY is attribution, and then NC is non-commercial. And then he goes back a week later to a BY license, just the attribution ones, and he said, fatally, this is the last time I will switch my Flickr license, and that was the case until today. And he talks about Brett Gaylor. And he pushes all of his photos out into a CC0 license.
Yeah. Now, the wonderful thing about... So, there's a difference between being mandated to do something and doing something voluntarily. So, something that Alan talks about in that post is that even if he is using his own post... Sorry, his own photograph on his own post, he will still attribute himself. And he'll do that... even if it's a CC0 license and it's in the public domain.
But why would he do that?
Because what you're doing is... So let's get to the bit why you would do that to yourself. And let's just imagine that it's you and me. So let's say that you're writing a blog post and I've shared a blog post, an image, whatever it is, under a CC0 license. you might want to either show that relationship that we have, or you might want to, you know, you might, for me, a lot of the time when I'm putting stuff out there, I, in the wake of Delicious, and I don't bookmark everything on pinboard.in, I do put a lot of stuff on there, I want to be able to refine stuff, and really, the web is my hard drive. And, you know, if I search my name and a particular search term, I can usually find what I'm looking for. So for me, it's like almost bookmarking that, remember, this is where you got the image from, even if I don't have to attribute it. So there's a website called Unsplash, which I've started using for a lot of my blog post images, that explicitly uses CC0 licensed photographs, and they are beautiful. And you don't have to say where they came from, but the wonderful thing is, why wouldn't you? You know, you've chosen this wonderful photograph. Why wouldn't you say that, look, this fantastic person has shared this thing, so I can put them on my blog post? You don't have to.
It becomes a matter of simple courtesy and manners, doesn't it, in a way?
Yeah, yeah. So what I like is not obligating people to do stuff, but most people do it anyway.
Yes, absolutely, as sort of good practice. And Alan Levine uses Pixabay, Pixabay, .com, which is equally free image and videos you can use anywhere, which are HD quality, over 770,000 free stock photos, vectors, and art illustrations available. And which is similar to Unsplash, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And there's a lot of these. If you look into it, like if you type in CC0 images into your favorite search engine, there'll be loads. And to me, and I had a conversation with someone about this today, the further you push your work, like if you can find like a larger surface area to push your work to, then you're going to get more attention. And given that the web is the world's largest digital photocopier, you're never going to be able to protect content. You're never going to, unless it's a physical thing, you're going to find it very difficult to protect and monetize content as your main thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to have some accompanying service. You see what I mean? I tell you an interesting thing, just as in parentheses. Since I changed my digital literacies ebook away from a certain price to pay what you want, I've made more money. You can even put zero in there, but not everyone does.
Okay. Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it's a similar thing to what Radiohead did with one of their albums, was it?
Rainbows.
And they said, pay what you want. You can have it free, pay what you think it's worth. And a lot of the point is that people feel that money is a good payment system, and will pay some cash for whatever it is that they do. It's a bit like tipping at a restaurant. You know, you'll tip nothing or something or a lot, depending on what you feel is appropriate and what you can afford and all of that.
That's right. And you never know what situation that other person's in. It's going back to kind of the Stoic philosophy, isn't it? Like, you never know what's going on in that person's life. So, yeah, there's a road to not go down there, because it takes too much time, which we haven't got now. But there's an interesting, if you obligate people to do stuff, sometimes you're putting them in an awkward position. Whereas if you rely on just sociability, community, and that kind of stuff, then the people who were going to go and torrent it anyway, or people who were going to try and buy hook or by crook to get it for free, can just do so easily, and you haven't pissed them off. Like they are absolutely. So an example of this is Elementary OS, a Linux distribution. Mm-hmm. So I've downloaded the last couple of versions of that for free. I've put zero in the box, and I've just downloaded for free. The last one that was just released last month, I paid $25 for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't have to, but I chose to, because it's very useful, and why wouldn't I pay for it? Because I want the developers to keep on working on it.
No, interesting. Have you ever made a Wikipedia donation, by the way?
Yeah, every year.
Yeah, so I do that as well.
And other ones, Internet Archive. Uh-huh. I've got a monthly thing that goes to that, and what's the other one? The Open Rights Group as well in the UK, that kind of stuff. Basically, you get to a stage in life, for me anyway, you know, when I was at university, I wouldn't pay for anything that, if I could get away with not paying for something, I wouldn't pay for, because I couldn't afford to do it. But if you get to a stage of your life where you can pay for stuff, then I think you've got a moral obligation to, if you think something's worth existing in the world, then you should make it within your power to to make it continue existing. That's one of the things that our cooperative is doing. We've got a central pot. We take 25% off the work that we do, put in the central pot to pay for things like donations to Etherpad or particular causes that we want to give money to.
Mm-hmm. This is a nice idea. So I'm going we're going to enter into a conversation that we have a couple of posts that stem from Alan's post that we've just discussed. And I think we've covered Alan's post in its entirety.
Yep.
So I'm just curious whether the question I'm going to ask is relevant. So I think it is. So if Alan's working with Creative Commons now. We are Open Co-op, done some work, I think it's on with them as well. And so in the light that Creative Commons is has many different licenses, and yet Alan's moving over to CC0, you're, I think, recommending it in your post we're about to discuss. Is it, why have anything but CC0 if CC0 is such the right thing to have?
Well, there's a separate blog post which we'll talk about next week about different types of openness, but for me, open is a spectrum. It's not a light switch. Right? It's more like the thermostat that you turn up and down at different times. And there are different pieces of my work that I license in different ways. But I like to have a default that's as open as possible. So if you're an organization, for example, that has hitherto relied on protecting its IP, I don't think you'll ever get to a situation, really, unless you've got a radical change in the personnel in the organization or a crisis, you'll never get to a point where you flick the switch between all rights reserved and public domain. Like, you'll slowly move that along. Even Alan, when he's talking about in his post, he talks about flicking between CC BY and CC BY NC and then going back to CC BY. And then for me, CC0 is my default. I'm not saying it should be everyone else's default, but as somebody who, before being self-employed, worked for organizations that were funded either by the government or by users, you know, so JISC, schools, Mozilla, I feel like I'd almost be stealing if I wasn't giving that work back for free.
Yes, absolutely. But it's interesting. So you pick, it's one of the things that I thought about this is that I can share everything that I produce digitally to a certain extent because I have a full-time job and I'm not depending on it. Nolan touches on this. It's like sharing things CC0 makes sense if you personally are not looking to make money out of that source material.
Yeah.
And I'm not, because I'm not looking to make money out of anything on my blog. I'm just looking to share it with the world for whatever reason, and in case it's helpful to anybody else, but also to reflect on my own practice. So when there's something that I think I really need to hone my thinking on, I will put it out there, and it will help me hold myself accountable to the quality of my work. So I don't need to make money out of that. And if somebody else can, I am not bothered, I don't think. But then maybe somebody like Pearson's going to come along, who make loads and loads of money and sort of exploit the educational world, possibly in ways that I don't agree with. What do I do then? I mean, would I be as happy with that situation, do you think?
All right, well, let's say that someone like Pearson comes along. I mean, Pearson would never do this, so let's just get that out there. Pearson would never do this because they've got lawyers going through this. But let's say that actually you didn't have a Creative Commons license on there and you had all rights reserved, and they mistakenly or on purpose or whatever, some for-profit organization came along and used your work verbatim for their own reasons, and they started making money off it. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What would you do?
Well, I don't think I'd do anything. I might sort of piss
him off. You'd be cross, though, wouldn't you? You'd be angry.
In the first instance. However, I think that I would reflect upon it and think, this can do me nothing but good. Even though they were making money out of it, the fact that I could somehow bring attention to the fact that I had produced something that was being used by such a large organization to make money would, in the long term, midterm, no, do me nothing but good, I would imagine.
Right. So this is the point where we mix together my post and Maha Bali's, because one of the things she talks about is a story from her Sudanese friend, and she says that she made a book because they didn't have enough books where she was in Sudan, and she started using the books with others in her family, and then she went to the Ministry of Higher Education, offered her services. When she went there, she said the Ministry of Education said, "We've already got that book," because someone had kind of badly photocopied it and made it available everywhere. And it said, Maha says, "Someone stole her book. Someone stole her work and gave it to others. Copyright violation. Someone used her work without attributing it to her. Plagiarism. This kind of things happens in my world all the time. Someone can take the work you did and attribute it to themselves and make money off it, even if you had been offering it for free. That bothers me." Okay? So I guess what Maha's saying is that CC0, it's all very well kind of white guys in the 30s, 40s, 50s doing it because, hey, you're acting from a position of privilege, so it's you being benevolent, but it's not really going to affect your material life. Whereas for, you know, we've talked about Maha before, as a woman of colour living in Egypt or any other part of the world where women's rights aren't respected as much or copyright isn't respected, it's not really the same kind of thing, I guess you're saying.
Yes. Okay, so let's go through your post in more detail, shall we?
Well, so my main point, going back to the Pearson or for-profit example, is that, and this ties in with the Stoic thing as well, is, and just to quote myself, I'm very grateful to kind of Creative Commons for doing all the work they do, and I think it's necessary, but to, I say, quote, the thing is that despite all this being couched in legal language, which I'm very grateful to Creative Commons for doing, I'm never in reality going to have the time or inclination to be able to chase down anyone who doesn't subsequently release a derivative work under an open license, if I was using the share-alike thing, or actually uses it for commercial purposes, or doesn't attribute me when they should have done. So for me, what I'm doing is I'm preventing future frustration, anger, negative feeling by saying that if someone does rip off my work, then they're doing it with my blessing and my permission. And I realize that I'm saying that from a position of privilege.
Yes, you are. But that's fine. And I think it's a really good way to think about it, and an important way to think about it, because the truth of the matter is that you're not going to be able to chase someone down. And even if you can, all you can do is hold them to public account for it. And they can just say, well, they care. And then you can say, well, this person doesn't care to the world. And, you know, some people might listen and it might have an effect on something, but you don't really know.
And as Maha says in her post as well, how do you find out about most people using your work? You find out about it not by you sitting there while someone else is using your work. No one's stupid enough to do that. It's usually when they think they can get away with it by being in some different country in an obscure conference or whatever it is, and someone saying, hang on a minute, that's an image by Brian Mathers and you've just scrubbed his name off there because I recognise his style. Or I'm sure I read that on Di Barnes' blog or whatever. So I think, guess what Maha is saying is that you have to have a certain amount of reputation and the privilege that goes with it to be able to have, for your reputation to precede you. And like today, one of my former colleagues at Mozilla, Melissa Romain, saw that a guy, Arke from Sweden, had remixed my work into this MakerBox thing, which we had a conversation about. And then that was being used in a library in America that she was an event at. And that's great. It's wonderful to know my work's being used there. Like, am I going to be nitpicky looking to see if they've spelt my name right, made sure that they haven't changed anything in my 8 essential elements of digital literacies? No, because I've just put it out there for people to use as they want, which means that I can just have that as a positive experience rather than, oh my goodness, have they kept to the terms of the license agreement?
Yes, and it's just about foregoing the nitpicking and all of this. It also encourages not to be so precious about your work as well.
It does.
Which is not a bad thing, I think.
Mm. Have you ever put Amazon affiliate links on your website?
I did for a little while, once upon a time, yes.
Why did you take them off?
Why did I take them off? Because I felt like, so I've played about with advertising on my blog, advertising on YouTube videos, and I don't really get a lot of traction on my stuff, so I don't really worry about it. I wasn't making any money out of it, but I just thought that's not in line. I'm just doing this because I can. It's not in line with what I'm doing. So I did think for a while that if I did the Amazon affiliate stuff, that if something that I liked on Amazon that I had purchased, if I went and got that for someone and I put it on my blog and somebody else liked it as well and they went and I would make some money out of it, that would kind of make sense. But then I just thought I'd make such little money and it's just all a lot of rubbish and stop it.
I once made 40 quid in a quarter when some people clicked through and bought some stuff off Amazon. I think it was just before Christmas or something like that. That's the most money I've ever made in like 3 months on Amazon. And you just think, well, there's no point. And really, why should I be forcing people to go there or whatever? And for me, this is difficult to explain. The easiest way is to say that I want a different kind of relationship with the people who are using, reading, enjoying, remixing, repurposing my stuff than I want you to go here to make money for me, or I want you to use my stuff in a way that I control, or anything like that. You know, when Maha says that she would hate it if somebody took something out of context in her thesis, she said, my thesis is CC by NCND, so that means it has to be attributed to Maha, it can't be used for commercial reasons, and it can't be modified in any way. My thesis is CC by NCND because hell no, I don't want people taking parts of my thesis out of context and doing stuff with it. And then she says, though, isn't that exactly what we do when we quote someone's work in text reference?
To be fair to Maha, she talks in a very sensible way about that, I think.
Yes, she does.
Is that we're doing that all of the time, and it's just it's almost it's sort of cyclical, isn't it? Everything just jumps around and we're doing it, and well, even though we don't intend to, or we do things with the best of intentions, you're always decontextualizing something by quoting something.
I always enjoy Maha's post because she's very much thinking aloud and it's coming from a position that I'm not in. You know, again, she always reminds us of checking our privilege and that kind of thing. So yeah, I guess that I would always, and this is why the co-op is called We Are Open, etc., I'd always be trying to push people along that spectrum of openness, and my approach for doing that would be the kind of Socratic asking questions approach of, well, if you do this and you do that, aren't you acting against each other? A bit like Maha realized she's doing when she's saying, you know, we quote people, even, you know, you can quote people out of context, you can quote people to illustrate an exactly opposite point. And so I would always say that the less precious you are about your work, in the end, the way that the web economy works, the better off you'll be.
And without this wanting to come around too sweetly, the idea of not being so precious about your work aligns with a sort of stoicism approach that you can control everything.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, stoicism is all about stuff that you can control and stuff you can't control. And if there's somebody on the other side of the world ripping off your work, there's very little you can do about that in real terms. You can get cross and angry and stamp your feet and whinge about it online and threaten people, but that's going to have much more of a negative effect on you than it has on them. So people will do what they will do, and sometimes you might want to facilitate that, like Radiohead did with In Rainbows, like I've done with my ebook. Hey, if you want to give me nothing for it, do it. Like, I'll encourage you to do that. If you want to give me something for it because you're in a position to do that, excellent. You know, whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to an interesting, for the natural progression of this, when you talk about copyright in this way, is that you look at what happens when you want to protect you've made something and you want to make money out of it. So a lot of what we're talking about is digital content that is not made to make money directly. But what happens when you make digital content such as we're looking at In Rainbows by Radiohead, such as that? So I found this article today on a site called Folkvinger, I think it's pronounced. And it's not English, I think it's European.
This is the guy who was one of the people behind the Pirate Bay, I believe.
That's right. And it's behind Pirate Party, so yes, Pirate Bay as well, yeah, by application. 10 years old, more or less. And anyway, this article is called "The Copyright Monopoly is a Scam That Hurts Artists as Much as the Public." And so that's an interesting idea, that copyright is the way, is the means through which an artist makes money from their work, be it music, kind of visual art, videos, movies, whatever. And he's sort of arguing the idea that the copyright monopoly is something that's so wrapped up in big business, is that you can't actually, as an artist, you never have the, or very few artists have the means by which to assert their legal rights over something. And even if you do, and so therefore it's just kept to the realm of big business. And even if you do have that that power to be able to assert those rights, that you're still not stopping lots and lots of people accessing your material via, in the ways that they do, you know, Putlocker and such like, peer-to-peer stuff.
Mm. No, exactly.
Which is, and that's quite interesting. But anyone who's interested also on this site, there's a lovely set of 7 historical posts that are talk about how copyright emerged in history, and that it emerged when Queen Mary tried to reinstate Catholicism as the national religion in the UK, and which she failed to do. But as a process of that, she gave control of all publishing materials, to a certain organisation, and this gave birth to copyright, which still exists to this day.
Hmm.
So there's a
great paragraph in this particular article. It says, "The big lie of the copyright monopoly is that it can make any dent whatsoever in social mores. Some people may download your work for free, but they'll also pay you if they like you. Some people may plagiarize your work, but the internet makes it easier than ever to expose them and laugh them out the room. Some people may take your work and remix it into something that expresses a political opinion you disagree with, but sometimes we can't control how people interpret our work anyway. Nobody really thinks about who the rights holder is on anything in these situations. They just worry about who the author is, and they act accordingly." End of quote. So there's some, you know, it's a great post, and I haven't read this before, Di. So he talks about make your work Creative Commons Zero to completely obliterate your monopoly so nobody can take it away from you. It's similar to a guy called Errol Balkan. Have you come across him before?
No.
He is behind Indie, that you might have heard to talk about. So Indie was going to be, they were going to make a mobile phone, then they're going to make a social network and all this kind of stuff. I don't entirely sure what they're doing now. I think they've escaped the UK because of the repressive Digital Economy Act and other things. But they made, in a similar way that we've done with We Are Open, they made their company limited by guarantee rather than limited by shares. Because if you make a company limited by shares, then someone can come along, buy up all the shares, or, you know, everyone apart from you could sell their shares to some rapacious capitalist company, and they could take over your company. Whereas if it's a company limited by guarantee, the most number of shares you ever get is 1. And you're limited by the guarantee that you do to do the things in your articles of incorporation. So it's much more of a guarantee that you will continue doing the type of things you were set up for, if that makes any sense. And Creative Commons Zero is in the same vein as that.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it's one of the problems about time, of the modern world, as it were, is how organizations can sustain their original intentions for what they build their services for. And we've seen this with Twitter as a good example. And how they, you know, and we do need new models for how this can be kept, and that sounds quite appropriate. So you're not, because the idea that Twitter go public and they sell it, and then they have shareholders, and now they must double their numbers every year, you know, their users every year, or the number of likes every month, or whatever it might be, to meet their shareholders' demands and to be seen as a thriving company and all of that sort of thing.
It's funny, you know, if you sent this article to somebody. I'm trying to think of a way of phrasing this. My wife would say, to somebody normal. it would be a bit jarring, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, for example, in the About the Author section of this particular article, who, I don't know if this is his real name, Zachary Adam Zepper, He says, despite believing that money is a superfluous social construct, he has a GitTip profile. Like, for me, as somebody who spent years reading this kind of stuff, who was dabbling with Linux when they were 16, you know, was messing about with Tor as soon as it came about, all that kind of stuff. I've read loads of stuff like this and much more left-wing as well. So it doesn't really have the same effect on me anymore. But to me, it's almost like the film The Matrix or something akin to that, where you realize that, oh my goodness, like the whole of society, and this is the philosophical background that I bring to all these stuff, like the whole of society is made in such a way as to make me think a particular way. But if I just break through that very thin veneer and you get through to the side, which is what a lot of these people have done. There's people who live without money. There's people who only deal in Bitcoin. There's people who, live by couch surfing other people's houses. It's easy to kind of caricature these people, but actually what they've done is realize there's a whole different way of operating in the world. And for me, you don't really need to go as far as that, but there's little things that you can do within the construct and the way that society is structured, which shows that you're not really playing the same game as everyone else.
Yes, indeed. I'd be more interested to take this article and shed it of its author and its actual context and just see what people thought about it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? So there's different extensions. You could do that. You could copy and paste it into a... It's under a CC0 license. Do what you want.
That's what you want. It's quite interesting. So I'm thinking, as we're talking and as I've been thinking about this today, I'm doing a presentation Zen project with my year sevens at the moment. And they get, so we could look at sort of the idea of stickiness in a slide and concreteness and emotional connection and things like that. And so they're charged with finding a question that they think is worth answering. And then those questions go into a hat and they have to answer each other's questions, and they get 5 slides at 10 seconds each, and the slide is only allowed an image on it, and they have to write what they're going to say in the notes of that slide, other things. So I'm thinking for the pictures that go on those slides that they're going to have to be CC0 pictures as another sort of limitation to what they're doing, and that will allow me to have a lesson with them or half an hour with them about copyright and explore that in some way. Sounds like fun. Have you died? Okay, it's just me now, everyone.
I was muted while I was talking. So, you know, people who are advocates, including myself, of more women and girls in STEM education and STEM subjects, they something which I've seen, which is a nice little phrase, is people can't be what they can't see, which is why you need more diversity in tech, for example, why you need to do almost, what do they call it in America, affirmative action or reverse discrimination or whatever you want to call it, to try and balance things out. Because, you know, if people don't feel like people like them do that kind of stuff, they're not even going to aim for it. And for me, there's an element of that in, you've talked about this before, Di, exposing people to stuff that they otherwise wouldn't see in other contexts. So you work in a pretty exclusive private school. In what other situation would kids like the ones you get see about free culture, see about Creative Commons Zero, about all that kind of stuff? Like,
yes,
you see what I mean?
No, I think that's quite important, and I do worry about this. So I find ways of like squeezing this into the curriculum that I teach, but it's certainly not taught by any other teacher. And it's also, I've had people coming to me recently in the last couple of weeks saying that, you know, geographers saying the geography pupils or the pupils' Excel skills are rubbish. What are we going to do about this? And I'm like, and I just sort of look them straight in the eye and say, well, if there are skills that your pupils require, then you should be teaching them. And it's this idea that that as our tools change, that the teachers actually become responsible for providing the skill set in some way that is going to help their pupils achieve the work that they want them to achieve. So whether it's graphing in a spreadsheet package or whatever it might be, and they sort of look at me as though it's my fault that that a pupil doesn't know how to use the fill handle in a spreadsheet. And I'm like, well, it's not my fault. It's not my job. But it is in some way. And I am looking at ways, and I think that's going to be a big thing for the curriculum in general at my school, is giving different departments the idea of responsibility of teaching a certain skill set within software applications.
It's very difficult to follow through on that, though. I mean, I guess something like Open Badges might work in terms of checking that people have done it because you could point to the evidence. But any time I've seen anything equating to digital literacies or anything taught across the curriculum, it tends to just fall down because people see it as, well, that's my secondary aim, and my first aim, if it comes to the crunch, is the stuff to do with my subject.
I know, but I think it's I think so, but I think also what we're kind of feeling is this sort of natural evolution, that as more technology is used, teachers use it more, pupils use it more, that the teachers are going to demand certain skills, but they have an expectation, or they do not have an expectation, that they're going to have to teach those skills, when actually the very fact that they're asking me is them realizing that those skills need to be taught and that they need to teach them.
I, in some ways, would love to see this put onto the kids themselves, especially if they're 14 plus or whatever. So here's, and I'm going to use the term passport because it's a kind of construct that everyone knows what I mean by it, but something like that, where you say, right, in order to get your digital skills passport or whatever it's going to be, here's all the different things, here's all the different badges, here's all the different experiences, all the different things you have to be able to do. And those experiences, those badges, those whatever you want to call them, are available not just in one subject, but in many different subjects. And it's up to the student themselves to almost pester the teacher to allocate them and sign off on the thing with evidence that they've done that, rather than everything always being an extra burden for the teacher.
I would agree, but I think it's in my vision of how this might be solved, I am thinking that kind of thing. I'm thinking that the teachers will know how to point their pupils toward the instructional material required to do these things, and that it'd be up to the pupils to actually go and do them. Because at the end of the day, these are generally speaking a lot of very simple techniques that are used in software applications, and people just need to remember where the guidance is for this stuff.
Well, it's like, you know, you did that MOOC. You took a MOOC that was already happening, and you got, was it some of your sixth formers to do it?
Yes. So sixth form, it was year 12 and year 10.
So group-based self-directed learning.
Yeah. Well, really, it was just a steer. More than anything else, it was just like a kind of well-organized steer from our end, pushing the pupils in these directions and giving them recognition and telling them the opportunities available to them. Why don't you do it now?
This is sanctioned. This is worth paying attention to.
Exactly.
We will recognize the fact that you have completed this thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's it.
Right. Anything else to say on licensing educational content, Di?
No. Other than, is it worth mentioning, what's the American system we talked about a couple of weeks ago, I think, by teachers for teachers thing?
The teachers pay teachers.
That's it, teachers pay teachers.
Yes, Howard Rheingold is just, totally name dropping. Howard Rheingold has just tweeted me to say, because I kind of quoted his tweet and said that there's a DML post. Did he write? I'm not sure. It basically was an elementary school teacher who's earned more than $100,000 by selling her curriculum to other teachers. And I was just like, yeah, this is the marketization of everything. He was saying, I see no problem in many upsides to teachers paying teachers. My mother was an elementary school teacher, very low pay. And he has a bit of a dig. So many intellectuals conflate commerce and capitalism. And my response, as I've just said, is that, when there's systemic injustice, then the market often comes in as the savior of everything, doesn't it? And Audrey Waters has just said that she's a bit shocked to see this in DML. But I feel like teachers paying teachers is almost the exact opposite of what we've been talking about with licensing your work with CC0. And it's people responding to financial incentives, and, you know, good luck to them, because the system is rigged or set up incorrectly. So why is... People do sell the resources in the UK through the TES, etc. I was asked, I had still had some resources on there, and I remember getting the email saying, hey, why don't you do this and, you know, get paid for it? But I, although it's moderately successful, I don't think it's anything near Teachers Pay Teachers. And I think we've got a slightly different system over here, which is possibly a bit more collaborative, I don't know. But I would certainly think that, on the whole, whilst I wouldn't castigate any individual teacher for selling their own resources, I think that a whole system where people are being paid by the state for doing stuff, if they're then selling that, I think that there's something wrong with the system. You're either not paying teachers enough, or there's the not the right culture within the teaching profession, if you see what I mean.
Yes, no, I think that's right. It is pointing that out, isn't it?
Hmm.
Right, so that's it on CCO and CC0.
Hmm. Well, on a lighter note, in the miscellaneous section, I don't know if you saw this article in The Guardian. The title is funny enough, to be fair. English man spends 11 hours trying to make a cup of tea with Wi-Fi kettle.
It's a long time to make a cup of tea. Mm. So we, quite interestingly, I have a coffee machine that was bought off eBay for £20 sitting in a box in my classroom, because one of my pupils a couple of years ago here, who's a scientist in the main, called Clovis, he bought this machine, or we bought it for him, and he wanted to make it so he could use his phone to communicate over the Wi-Fi to get this machine to make him a cup of coffee. And he tried, great persistence on his part, and to get this coffee machine working again, and never did. And so it just sits there, and I have to work out how to dispose of it. I have no idea. But so this guy has spent 11 hours waiting for his high-tech kettle to boil the water.
Hmm.
Did he succeed?
No, he didn't. Well, in the end, he did. So, you know, you can read through the tweets on the funny thing. The Guardian's picking up on this guy, Mark Rittman, who is a data specialist who lives in Hove, England. He set about trying to make a cup of tea about 9 a.m., but basically, first of all, the Wi-Fi kettle wouldn't connect with the base station. Because he kind of knew his stuff, instead of just taking it back to the shop, he started debugging it. Then he figured out what was going on, and then he realized that, actually, there was no point in having this Wi-Fi-enabled kettle if it wasn't voice-activated. So he then managed to write some kind of script to, I think it was Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. So he could say, Alexa, make me a cup of tea. And it would just do it automatically. And he got there 11 hours later. To be fair, there's one person, and they quote this at the bottom of the Guardian article, it says, why don't you get a normal fucking kettle?
Yes. That's the deal.
There's a serious point to this, though, that at the moment we don't need to debug our stuff. I mean, if it's a cup of tea, then yes, you can be gasping for a cup of tea, but there's more serious points as well. So, for example, if you've got Wi-Fi enabled lights, I've got some in my house, someone made the point that each individual light is not going to have a private key. It's not going to be like... Although the whole thing is encrypted in terms of your Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff, like each individual one won't be. And so, did we have the conversation last week about the botnet made of CCTV cameras?
No.
So the big thing now, you know, it used to be that, especially with Windows machines, you'd have to have virus checkers and malware things and everything like that, and people would have, you know, people's machines would be infected with spyware or ransomware, or the worst type really is when you don't realize you've got anything on there, and every so often some kind of criminal is using your machine, like millions of them all in one go, to do a distributed denial of service attack on a particular target.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember on BBC Click they did this years ago, where they actually paid to do a DDoS on using this service. So they use the deep web to purchase a million different computers around the world, to attack a certain website at a certain time that they'd all listed.
So with the Internet of Things, things have got fast enough chips, because all it is just pinging a website at all at the same millisecond, to be able to get into those kind of... So things like baby monitors, CCTV cameras, loads of Internet of Things devices just don't have the level of security and have default passwords which people don't change, which means that criminals can get into them without you knowing. Yes, can do nefarious things in your house, like spy on you and stuff, but more prosaically, use your device to do this massive denial of service attack on people who have political opinions which they don't agree with, or whatever it is. And mm-hmm. so it's a huge problem. And for me, that's why some people, there's even a Twitter handle for this, call the Internet of Things the Internet of Shit.
Yes, absolutely. And because it's opening up doors that we don't necessarily want to open. And it just gives me actually there's a little alignment between what we discussed about copyright here and the Internet of Things, or indeed the algorithms at play behind it all, and the use of Wi-Fi and the way that it's turning. And this gentleman spending a long time trying to debug his new Wi-Fi kettle, is that very few people are ever going to have the means by which to scrutinize these things once they're in place. So once it's possible to hack into your network via one of your remote devices, meaning that's on the outside, not encrypted, like through one of your lights, for example, and they can sneak away back into your network should they wish to, your means and capacity to actually investigate that and do something about it might be minimal, and certainly the normal person, as Hannah would put it, wouldn't stand a chance of doing that.
Even everyone really that I mean there's obviously people at Mozilla who I didn't know, but pretty much everyone I know at Mozilla who I did know, who knew huge amounts more than tech than I did, wouldn't have been able to do a security audit on like crypto stuff. That's why the first commandment of cryptography is you don't roll your own cryptography, because there's libraries, there's ways of doing stuff. There's, for example, today on Hacker News, I saw that the SHA-1 algorithm is being retired on the web because it's too easy to crack. Like, there's companies that do all stuff, but there's very few people who can do the security audit. And because there's so few people, it's easy for government agencies, the mafia, criminals, whatever, to get to them. So we're in a very bizarre world, I think.
So in a very bizarre world, how can you find a job that suits your personality?
Oh, you're doing the smooth daytime TV links, are you, Danny? Okay.
It's my job. So there's a post here called The Best Jobs for Your Personality Type, which I have not read. So tell us a little bit about this.
Can I just preface this with, I think the MBTI, Myers-Briggs personality types, are little better than horoscopes, really, but they are quite fun. Have you ever done one of these Myers-Briggs tests?
I have. I can't remember what I got.
Right. So I always come out as the same anytime I do this kind of thing. I come out as INTJ. All right. Mm-hmm. So I knew this before I scrolled down the very long infographic. It talks about four different types, the four dimensions of personality type: energy style, thinking style, value style, and lifestyle. And it divides them into kind of pragmatists, caretakers, theorists, and empaths. So obviously it was of no surprise to me that INTJ came out as strategic mastermind.
Superb. You are a strategic mastermind.
And the suggested jobs are software developer, technical writer, judge, or surgeon. So,
really?
I think the ship, or microbiologist, which is actually what my wife did at university. So I think the ship has sailed on me being a judge or a surgeon, probably a microbiologist as well. I could learn a bit more code. And I suppose I am quite good at making technical hard stuff a bit more accessible, which is the idea that I'm a strategic mastermind. I, and certainly my wife, found hilarious.
Yeah, I bet. Although I think others would pay more credence for that to you than you're giving it, possibly.
The thing I like about this is that I think growing up, young people should do as many of these as possible of all different things, just to realize that there's no objective judgment that you can make about you as a person, because you are not the same person from day to day, month to month, year to year, and you're an evolving thing. And so the more of these that you do, the more you realize, it's a bit like, I don't know if you've ever done this, Di, you know, if you need to make a decision and it's either turn left, turn right, yes or no, black or white, yeah? Have you ever flicked a coin, right, and then not seen what the answer is, and then thought, what do I want the answer to be?
I have never done that.
Have you not? Someone suggested to me years ago, probably when I was a teenager, and it's just a great way of making decisions, because what you do is you do the introspection through the forced act of having to make a decision about it. And for me, it's a bit like this. Like, how, if you realize by reading this, you pay it more, it's a bit like a horoscope. You read yourself into it. Like, it's, you pay more attention to this bit and you kind of play down this bit that doesn't really apply to you. And you kind of learn more about yourself, even though the thing that you're using as the convenient hypocrisy is obviously kind of bollocks.
Yes, but it serves a purpose within your own reflection.
I am the type of person who does this, you know. So I
like certainly, I know at school, and they did this in my last school and schools before as well, that they do this sort of careers test thing. It does an analysis. I don't remember the name of it. And then it suggests that, you know, they answer lots and lots of questions, and then it suggests to them what type of jobs they would be suitable for. I bet it deals with some of this stuff and Myers-Briggs and all that kind of thing underneath it, although it doesn't call itself that.
Are you going to do another nice little segue, or?
Oh, no, I'm just going to be bold and say, what's the last thing? Coding is not fun. It's technically and ethically complex.
Yes. So this is Aeon, quite a short article, I think. And it's just basically saying that there's another podcast I listened to about this as well. It, like, when you make things fun and easy, sometimes you reduce the importance of it. Yeah, it's always going to be a fine line and a balance. So there's have you tried the new Apple Swift programming app on the iPad?
No, I avoid it at all possible costs.
Why is that?
Because I teach programming with code. So and therefore my pupils learn to write in code, and I make that fun. And I do
so
that.
So this is the point that, was it this article or one of the things I was listening to? I seem to remember that I listened to this, but it's making the same point. It's basically saying that if you do things in a visual way, even if you're not trying to do this, you're constricting what's possible. When you do code, like, literally anything's possible. You're giving them the keys to the kingdom right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you try and scaffold a bit and make it friendly and easy and stuff and give them the training wheels, like, it's a lot harder. For me, the metaphor I'd use here is the difference between, and I did the wrong thing here, you know, I put training wheels, I put stabilizers on my daughter's bike, as opposed to giving her one of those balance bikes, yeah?
Yeah.
It, for me, it's a similar kind of thing. Like, you constrain what's possible. So the point that this article is making is that you shouldn't be making code fun and interactive like Tim Cook, who's CEO of Apple. What you should be doing is making people realize that coding is hard and complex, and you have to make decisions and things. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, I mean, as a teacher of code, I think this is a big deal. So I use Scratch to teach coding at a certain level, but I do that with year seven, and it does make it fun. However, the best fun, the most enjoyed projects that the children have done. So the way I teach Scratch is we offer them three projects to do, which I think I've probably discussed on here before. One is a helicopter, and build the helicopter game, where you keep the helicopter in the air avoiding obstacles, which is sort of built. The other one is a maths quiz, where we give them the building blocks of the maths quiz, and the first question is done, and they have to go and build on it and then do point scoring and stuff like that, and competitions and things. And then the other one is a text-based adventure game, harking back to mine and my colleagues' childhoods. and where they have to do this quite, which they find incredibly engaging, this text-based adventure game where they have to introduce lots of different variables about their day in the life at the school, and they have to have like pink cards, green cards, particular teachers appearing, different weather, whether you forgot your umbrella, you have to go back, you know, lots of different penalties, and pluses, whether you get commendations in class for your work and that kind of thing. And so what comes out at the other end is always really, no, not always, is often very creative, really complicated coding that they're doing, but they do that in Scratch sort of thing. So they like the interactive element in that because it allows them to quickly give graphical feedback to the process of what they're doing. And within the time constraints that I have to teach them that, I welcome this shiny, colorful, GUI, immediate feedback, gratification interface. However, as soon as I get them at year 9, we go straight into text. There is no shiny, there is the fun is from successful code and nothing else. So you do this code, you get it right, this is your output. Your output is a you know, one digit on the screen, but the satisfaction is that you were able to assemble code that was not given to you and make it do what you want.
So you know what, before we've talked about Seymour Papert and we've talked about Mitch Resnick and the idea of low floor, high ceiling. So for me, code is a perfect example of that. Like, it's got built-in differentiation based on like how fast people want to go and learn and what they've done before and levels of abstraction that they can deal with and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So to force people into an environment where they have to go at a particular pace is problematic.
To force, yes. So I don't do that. And it's really hard work, to be honest.
Mm.
So in my year 9 classes, I have, I'll give them a GCSE programming guide. So I give them access to material that they can go and roll on with by themselves. That takes them up to everything that they'll need to know for GCSE. So they're looking at file handling, and looking at data dictionaries and things like that, that they have to be able to use through Python. And they go and that's how it takes them. And the different guides are sort of different levels of quality because of how many challenges they get the individuals to do, rather than just following instructions. And you know, it's little better than copy and paste stuff. And so I gave one pupil the guide the other day, and he came back the next day and it was finished. And this is this covered everything that you need for GCSE programming. Mm. And he's yeah, no. So he's moving on to different things really, really quickly because he has brought a lot of experience to the class beforehand, obviously, and is incredibly motivated.
It's weird, isn't it?
Children are struggling to write one program at the same time in the same class. You know, they're struggling to get one done and really understand it. Even if they're copying and pasting, they're just not getting it, and it's really hard work. So
I'd totally take my hat off to you, because differentiating and anything to do with languages is always going to be difficult, isn't it? So we can talk backwards and forwards as to whether there's a relationship which is more than a semantic relationship between, for example, learning a modern foreign language and learning code. I think there's enough similarity to make it a worthwhile comparison. But, you know, my kids do Duolingo before school every day, which means my daughter can speak way more Spanish than I can do. My son's almost catch him up in terms of, like, functional and practical French. And so when they come to do languages properly, they won't need to do the really basic stuff because they already know it. But will they have to go through those stage gates? Absolutely. Because they've had to do it with everything else. And it always seems like a bit of a shame, and like we don't really account for the springboards that children are getting elsewhere, either because of their home environment or because they've just had a combination of life experiences which means that they get that abstraction or whatever it is. So, yeah.
Well, I have a really big concern about this at the moment. So I remember once upon a time at my former school, we used to teach medieval history, which is quite rare as an A-level, quite rare. And a lot of pupils who were good at this and were going to university to do some kind of medieval history course But because so many other pupils on the course had not done medieval history, the first year was spent doing the A-level, effectively. And they'd done it all, and done it very well because they were on this course, whatever. And so I found in my investigations into what's going on in higher education with computer science that this is exactly what's going on. Because there is no uniform, hard A-level, hard qualification, which is maths usually for computer science stuff, because that's the universal one. So if you do a computer science A-level, you then go on to study computer science. You spend the first year basically doing the computer science A-level because the mathematicians are all catching up to speed, kind of thing. And now that's even ramped down one step further. So the new GCSE, the 9-to-1, rather than the A star nonsense that's just been implemented, is now called computer science, where it was called computing before. It's taken away that it's now 20% with one controlled assessment of coursework, practical work, and two papers that go with it, rather than before it was two controlled assessments worth 60% in total of the final grade and a 40% written paper. But the new computer science GCSE overlaps with the A-level, which was only a year older than it, so it was only devised a year beforehand, so for last September. And they have a lot of the same content on it. So the actual depth to which they go the A-level goes a little bit deeper, but not a lot. So that means that when the GCSE pupils that I have come on to do the A-level in my subject, they're going to be repeating a lot of the stuff that they've done before to allow the A-level computer science qualification to be accessible to those that have never studied computer science before. And this is really gets my goat about school curriculums or curricula, is that if you do maths or French or whatever, and you've been doing it since you were five or whatever, then by the time you get to the qualification stages, you are very, very skilled within this discipline. Whereas those things that you do not do, it becomes really hard, and it's not really acceptable to have GCSEs that repeat A-level content. And they're still learning how to get this right, I think, in such an extraordinary way. And I don't have enormous amount of faith in the people at the exam boards who are writing the material, because it's not good enough as far as I can see.
And we talked about this before in terms of how to scaffold certain subjects and how to test out of things. So, you know, going back to the Duolingo example, my wife has been inspired by my children learning French and Spanish, and she did German GCSE, and she attempted to test out of the first few levels, and the test results said that she needed to go back and start the beginning. But you know, that kind of thing you can do because there's a definite starting point, there's a definite structure to it, and there's a way in which you can represent it in an ordered, sequential way. And I think you can do that with computer science, but you can't do it with every subject. So it's in subjects where you can't do it, then you're always going to be gaining by going wide instead of deep. But in subjects where there is a certain way of doing things, you're always going to be holding people back if you don't let people test out of things and go that bit higher.
Yes, indeed. I'd really like to hear, speaking of Duolingo, I'd really like to hear from any teacher who has used Duolingo education version in the school, and the results that they found that had with their pupils and sort of languages teachers, you know. So I'm sort of always trying to say to language teachers, have you seen this? This looks as though it might, you know, have some bearing on your subject. And what do you think of it? But I'd really like to hear if someone else is sort of evaluation of it, who is in their role. So it's a languages teacher, and they do it, get their pupils to use it and follow their progress in a similar way that you're doing, but not as in with your children, but from the educator's point of view, you know what I mean? And Duolingo was made by a gentleman called Louis von Ahn, and who's done crazy good stuff, like sorting out Google Images back in the day using human computation, and is responsible for capture and recapture as well, that we all use.
So if you're listening to this, if you are doing that with Duolingo, not just using it with a couple of kids like I am, but using it kind of in the enterprise education version, then let us know. And also, if you have got any thoughts about licensing educational content, if you have been inspired to change your own work to CC0 or a less restrictive license, do let us know. We'd like to celebrate that. And if you've got any stories about the Internet of Things going right or going wrong, let us know too.
Yeah, and get into the Slack channel as well, tidepodcast.slack.com, and join in. That'd be great.
What are you going to do? You're on holiday again next week as well, aren't you, Ty?
Yeah, no, I have another, I don't know, I think in the teens days off left. So I'm going to enjoy them. I'm going to relax, recharge my batteries, catch up with some work, developing a couple of online communities to do with my work. And that's that, I think.
Mm. Well, by the time this goes out, there'll be some big news about open badges, I guess, will have been published, which we can discuss next week. Uh-huh. I had a bit of a preview last week, and it's kind of embargoed at the moment. I think, given that it hasn't been posted yet, it's probably going to go out tomorrow.
Okay.
But it's all good news, and it's fine. So there's that. So because of that news, I would have liked to be in Bologna next week for the EPIC conference. So ePortfolios and Identities and Open Badges kind of conference, which I was at last year in Barcelona. It's in Bologna this year. There's going to be a lot of former colleagues and friends who are going to be there, but I couldn't really take the time out of half term, and I'm at the Mozilla Festival next week as well. So,
all right. I'm going to pop along to Mozilla Festival, I think, either on the Friday or the Saturday, so I'll make sure I let you know. But we'll talk about that next week probably anyway.
Yes, because we'll have a recording before that. So yeah, just working and writing and carrying on with the usual. I think we're going to, bizarrely, my children are off this Friday, and so is my wife and so am I, so we're going to go away to Robin Hood Bay near Whitby.
Oh, that's Whitby and Robin Hood Bay are a big part of my childhood, so you have a great time there, I'm sure you will.
Good. Well, have a good another relaxing week, Di, and I will talk to you next week.
Superb. Have a good week. Bye-bye, everyone. Sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.